Hey there, Friday Night Movie family. You are listening to a very special South by Southwest episode of the Friday Night Movie podcast. Tune in for all of the exciting interviews we have coming to you this week and beyond. And if you're at the festival, we hope you're having an amazing time. Extra buttery voice this morning on the Friday Night Movie podcast. Just about to head to the plane, but I have an awesome opportunity to talk to Jonathan Ignatius Green, director of Dickweed, which is maybe one of the coolest names for a doc. But however charming the name is, I feel like I was watching like a real life Coen Brothers movie. Mm. While watching this story unfold, just to catch everybody up, the film starts with a graphic description of a kidnapping and graphic removal of a man's penis. They don't show it, but they talk about it. And that just hits you right from the get-go. You don't hold anything back, but then like that's like a cold open, and then we're right into this like incredible crime thriller, even though it's a doc. I want to start right there with your decision to structure the story that way, because docs get, you know, was that always the plan, or was that?
It's a tough one. There were so many different versions of this film, and so much about Doc is like who you finally end up getting access to be your main storytellers. And so once we had done Detective Peter's interview, he was clearly going to be the hero of the story that was going to, he was going to be our main storyteller. And so then we kind of wanted to stay in his point of view, because for him, obviously not having omniscience of what's going to happen, he's learning what he learns as he goes. And so are we as the audience. And obviously a mystery, a big question mark at the beginning, which is who the hell are these people, is a great engine narratively. So, it's a violent thing. You kind of just want to get it. It's really gnarly, and you just kind of want to get it over with and let the, it's going to be recapped throughout, but we tried putting it later, and we tried doing some different things, and it was like, let's just go all in.
I love that you went all in, and then it was gnarly, grisly, but then it doesn't feel like you exploited that going forward, because I feel like it was like, whoa, and then I'm just wrapped up into this mystery, and it wasn't like I don't think there was too much, considering the subject and what you had working there wasn't a lot of exploitation of that or the person who it happened to, which you got an interview, a real interview. It's obscured, but that is the actual guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we met Michael at the trial back in 2019, and I mentioned that I was working on developing a project and so forth. And it was kind of like, oh, here's, you can reach out to my lawyer kind of thing, and which we did. And, you know, the project kind of had multiple lives. And then we'd fallen out of touch with a lot of the subjects until it got picked up by AMC. And then we reached back out. And when I actually interviewed Michael, the victim, he was like, you know, thanks for giving me time and not pressuring me. Because a lot of people just like, they just want what they want. And so he was really ready to tell a story. And that was another reason why, you know, even though it's, to your point, like we weren't going to be gratuitous with it. You have to be graphic to a degree that it gives you the gravity of what happened. But really to honor what his experience was, we had to walk that line and let him tell as much of it as he wanted to.
I really admire the way you did it, because when you put your hands, when you're doing an interview, I've set up lots of people for interviews in my previous career with doc people, and there's this thing you're always getting, and I'm sorry, my sister, my co-host, has been working in docs for 20 years, so she's going to be super jealous that I got to do this. But when you're on the preparing the interviewee side, you're essentially putting your life in the hands of the documentary filmmaker, because they are going to build the story as it goes along. You know, you don't know if they're going to use 1 minute or if you're going to be the whole storyteller.
Yep.
And you've given yourself over to them. How do you earn the trust of someone that like, given his experience, like, how could he trust anyone ever again?
Yeah, no, totally. And I mean, there's, yeah, I mean, earning trust with the subject is obviously, it's a case by case basis. I mean, he, Michael in particular, I mean, he's actually a pretty, like, just chill guy. I mean, and he was actually, like, just fine talking about even the graphic stuff. It didn't, like, I mean, he had his own journey, obviously, with PTSD and everything after the events. But, you know, we're, by the time we're doing our interview, it's almost 10 years since that. So, yeah, I think he kind of wanted to tell a story, and it's really about, you know, I'd only talked to him through lawyers until the day I interviewed him.
Wow.
So I was really just building rapport with him, like, through other people, and then...
That's really hard to do.
Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, again, he was really chill and brave, and he, you know, he had other people in the room with him and made him comfortable, and I was with my producer and main story collaborator, David Ricksecker, who, you know, been working on all the subjects with me, and so, yeah, we just tried to make him feel comfortable.
That's really cool. Okay, so you have the hero in the detective, you have the victim. I want to come back to the detective, but you also score, and this is like a great reveal in my view. It's like showing the shark later in the movie.
Exactly.
You score Hussein Nayeri in what I think must have been just an insane interview, because there's nothing about talking to that guy that makes me feel safer around that guy, whether or not he did it right. Like, cause there's a question, he has his own version of the story, but that is an intimidating character, who I guess you spoke to remotely mostly. Okay.
Yeah.
Cause it looks remote, but I wasn't sure if that was in a studio and then put on a laptop.
Right.
What is the strategy for then going and getting the sort of who turns out to be the villain in the story to participate?
Well, I mean, the kind of films that I'm interested in the true crime space I would always want the criminal. Like, my favorite true crime doc is Bart Layton's Imposter. And so it actually started with Hussein. He wasn't a later get. He was the first person we reached out to.
Wow.
And that was in 2019. That was before his trial. We'd written him a letter. And, of course, he was getting lots of letters from doc people and journalists and so forth. And he did a 2020 interview. They only used like 15 seconds of him or whatever. But I actually became acquainted with him over the years. And I drove down to the prison. I spent multiple hours talking to him through the glass with the phones and all that business. And you know, he's, as you might imagine, a bit of a slippery guy. So I didn't know until I knew that if he was going to actually go through with it. And then the kind of bummer was that we didn't get his interview until like 2 weeks before we had to picture lock.
Wow.
So I had, and I did it over the course of 7 days, and it was 10 hours.
Wow.
So I had 10 hours of Hussein, and I had to kind of shoehorn him into the structure we'd already built, which, you know, there's obvious places for him. But the initial version of this doc was going to be one of the main storytellers. So, you know, it's a doc's a moving target with how things kind of work out. You don't get to write a script and tell people when to show up at their call time.
Fair enough. Yeah, they're not exactly like on contract, like actors, right?
Yeah, especially him.
There is a haunting moment at the end where he says something to the effect of, like, make sure to put in your little project that this story is to be continued. And I felt like, having seen the footage that you used in the courtroom, where I read it as he essentially threatened the prosecutor. He basically said, like, you know, you want me to, you know, he essentially says, you want me to do what I did to this guy to you without saying it, which undoes his case. But I feel like that last comment isn't just, I might still be out there, but I feel like he maybe was directing like a little bit of, I don't know if it's threat, but a little bit of malevolence right in your direction. That dismissive thing about your project. Like, if he doesn't like it, you said you love talking to the criminal. Like, is that scary?
Or is that part of the fun? It's a long story, but I would say I've had some moments with Hussein, who goes by Adam. I've had some moments with him that made me uncomfortable.
Okay.
For the most part, we have great rapport, and we talk about all kinds of other stuff. We talk about books. We talk about, you know, what's going on. He's like, "How's the family?" Da, da, da. You know, and I'm obviously like being measured with how much I'm sharing about my life and so forth. But then again, I'm not. I'm kind of just an open book kind of guy, and I want to really relate to him as a human because there's something, you know, he's still human, I think. The last comment, it probably reads, which is kind of great that it read the way that you described it, but it's really more, I would say, his ego. That it's like, is he an eternal optimist or is he a narcissist? Well, he's both, because he always thinks there's a way that, like, there's always something that could happen that could go his way, and he's obviously had a lot of things going his way. He broke out of freaking jail.
I mean, the story of him breaking out of prison, which is in itself another documentary, as we were talking about before the interview. I love that I felt like when you think of prison breaks in narratives, it's almost always like. There's the whole show Prison Break. There's The Great Escape. There's Danny Ocean sneaking through the ceiling in Ocean's 11. It's almost impossible not to glamorize someone outsmarting the cops. And that's his version of the story. But I didn't feel like you were playing it heroic. I don't feel like you were glorifying these dangerous criminals getting out of jail. Am I on the right track there or? Yeah.
I mean, like you said, I think breaking out of jail is the ultimate underdog story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't get more underdog than that. You're behind bars and you get out. And so people are always going to kind of root for it, I think, because people just identify with the underdog in stories. That's how it works. So I think, like, if there's something that you could like about the things that Hussein has done, that'd probably be the thing, because it's like pretty phenomenal that he did it. It's like a Houdini move. Is it glorifying it? I don't know. I don't really think in those terms, but I think it was nice to be able to talk to him about his second crime, breaking out of jail, in a way, because it was nonviolent and effectively victimless. And he's very proud of it, that we could just have fun after all the stuff that he says he didn't do with the gnarly stuff in the desert.
Yeah.
It was nice to just get to the jailbreak and that he admits to, and he can kind of like be his cocky self and like feed into it and just let it, and just to have a little fun with it. Cause it was obviously for the public and for the cops who had major egg on their face.
I mean, it's they look scary, ridiculous.
But knowing that he got recaptured and stuff, and that it's in the past tense, it's kind of fun to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And he, the escape. I mean, the way he talks about it. You're right. He is very proud of that, and he almost views it as like validation of his innocence.
Yeah.
That these are a bunch of incompetent people.
Yeah.
That. That look how incompetent these guys are. And that was a really interesting victory for him. But another great moment, and this is where I felt like I was on a roller coaster ride on this thing, is that, and these are all choices you're making, so I want to hear about this one too, which is when you're interviewing Detective Peters, right? The DA, the woman, the DA, whose Heather, name escapes me, right? Heather, okay. When they talk about him leaving and they're like, was he trying to escape or does he have a list of people he's going to hunt down? And that I was like, whoa, yikes.
Yeah.
But also like such great storytelling, man.
Yeah. Thanks. There's a lot there to work with. I mean, we wanted to stay in because Detective Peters is really our hero. We didn't want to just, all of a sudden the movie doesn't include him. Like, and what is the emotional reality? Cause like we're just talking about, it's fun to talk about a jailbreak, especially when you know that nobody got hurt and he didn't go out and kill a bunch of people or something. It's obviously super scary for the people in real time.
Yeah. And I didn't know. So I didn't know the story. So I was like, holy shit, is the next act him hunting these people down?
Right. Exactly. So, we wanted to stay stay in their point of view as our heroes and what that was like emotionally for them. And they got, you know, police details put on their cars. They were like, I think for at least for a few days, they didn't send their kids to school. I mean, that's some scary shit. So yeah, we wanted to walk that line. And the interesting thing is too, is because it is past tense and everybody's safe, then they can, even the cops, you know, and the DA can kind of joke about it and stuff. But at the time it was not a joke. I mean, it was really scary for them.
Yeah. Speaking of scary moments, use reenactments throughout, which I feel like is a staple of a lot of true crime. How do you use that device? Why do you use that versus just the words or just the footage, or, you know, what's the strategy there? And then what's the strategy, because it, you know, of making it not like, look, all respect to Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted and all that, but this is a much higher art form. What you're doing here. How do you make sure it doesn't go into that territory?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess, you know, in doc you call scenes reenactments, but to me they're just scenes. You know, like this is, it's just a film. It happens to be a nonfiction story where we're going to include people talking, but it's just a movie in my head. You know, it's not like, oh, you're doing reenactments. Like, well, no, I wrote a script of what we're going to shoot, you know? So all that to say, you know, I think I always joke, like the thing that makes, you know, Magnolia not a soap opera is P.T. Anderson, you know, like, the material is kind of the same, you know, like this crazy story, blah, blah. And I think like with, you know, when you surround yourself with collaborators that have good taste and they know story and they know filmmaking and they don't come, you know, it's not just let's grab the shot and move on. Like we really care about it. Then hopefully it'll just feel like a movie because that's what we want to do. So I don't really think about it in terms of like being worried about it turning cheesy. I mean, some documentarians, they don't want to show actors' faces or they put things out of focus. And I'm like, I mean, and people come from all different backgrounds in doc. Obviously, a lot of people come from journalism, maybe not comfortable with like kind of film language, but I come from the film school side. And so to me, it's like, of course I'm going to show an actor's face. I'm going to put some dialogue in there, you know, because I want you to suspension of disbelief, just become enraptured in believing that, you know, intellectually that the actors are just the actors. That's fine. We know that when we see Meryl Streep perform, but we still get pulled in. Right.
Yeah.
So anyways, all that to say, you know, I just want to use the craft at my disposal to make the most impactful thing. So I love doing scenes, because I love movies.
Cool. Well, so speaking of movies, I felt like when we're starting with Michael's part of the story, I felt like I was watching like a Coen Brothers movie. Mm. Because like his version of the story is sort of like, or like his perspective for me felt like, you know, criminal who gets involved in something he doesn't know, maybe made some dumb decisions like going and partying with these guys in Vegas. And like the way that, like, it was like this, you know, series of unfortunate events. If you're making this into a feature, because it would make it, but then you have, when you bring in Detective Peters, then there's like just this like brilliant cop kind of like doing the procedural work, you know, procedural, I don't know if Alex Cross is the right example, but right. Like, you know, the like hero detective who's relentless, yep, and working the thing. That was the first one that came to my mind, but I'm sure there are other great detective things that are landing on my head right now. If you were to make this into, you know, full narrative, only narrative, like, do you have a style that you would want to be making it in? Like,
well, I mean, I think it's funny because the Coen brothers, you know, just like every filmmaker, they're so influential to people in the crime genre for sure, and really every genre. But, you know, I love their work. And I think what's so great about like Blood Simple or Fargo or some of the like staple Coen brother crime things is, and why we keep going back to them, is because they thread this line between the grisly and the comedic. And I mean, we call our movie Dickweed. You know, that's like the most homage thing to the Coen brothers possible. It's like, because just in the title, it's just like, oh, you're not taking yourself too seriously. And honestly, like, I wish we could have, you know, with other you know, you only get to build the house with the bricks you have in documentary. So if you don't get that character or this thing, or you don't, you know, it's, you got to build a different house. But my original conception of this was to really try to, you know, have those levity things that like give you reprieve and then hit you with the grisly stuff. And that that would be kind of a tonal roller coaster. And so, yeah, I love that. And I would definitely, if I were to make it into a scripted feature, then I'd try to find that tone, and you could kind of build your own bricks. So yeah, then you'd have a little more options.
Yeah, I mean, because you just, you have all the characters. You have, you know, you're like, Hussein reminds me of Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a little bit more of a competent cop than you usually have in a Coen Brothers movie. But then you also have the rich dad that, like, I was thinking, like, Lebowski vibes.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. And I was watching The Big Lebowski, you know, for the 400th time the other day.
Big favorite on our show. Big favorite.
Yeah. And I was watching it with Jay, who works with me at my company. And he'd only seen it a couple times. And you know, we hadn't watched it since we made Dickweed. And he's like, dude, they talk about cutting a guy's dick off like 10 times in this movie. In The Big Lebowski. And I was like, yep. Because there is something so horrible, yet we always giggle when we hear about that kind of heinous thing. I mean, because, I don't know, dicks, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just like, it's just so Coen Brothers, that film, that nobody's going to cut your dick off, dude, you know, like over and over.
You're wearing a great hat right now. I want to take a picture at the end. You're wearing a great hat. It says "Make Video Horizontal Again," which I'd love to hear your take on that. But there's also some vertical cell phone footage in this movie, which I think is really interesting. Yeah. Connected statement or just overall comment on the state of film and video?
My son got this for me because I, you know, I'm one of this old man yells at sky kind of guy when it comes to film technology. You know, not that I think everything should be shot on celluloid or something, but you know, it's one of those things. You get a few drinks in me, and you talk, and you show me your vertical video, and I'm just, dude, our eyes go this way on our head, not this way. Like, what the actual F? So, anyways,
you were not a Quibi investor.
No, well, as it turned out, that didn't work out very well. So, yeah, no, not so much.
So you've been at South by Southwest now probably for a few days, soaking it all up. Do you get a chance in a situation like this to see other people's stuff, or is it just go, go, go with your movie?
No, yeah. I mean, as soon as our premiere, you know, happened on Saturday afternoon, you know, it's like, and then we kind of partied with the crew and everybody that were in town, you know, for the rest of that day. And then, you know, I started watching movies, one of the reasons I'm here. So, yeah, well, that got to meet some other filmmakers and filmmakers I hadn't seen in a while.
I mean, that's a great thing about, I don't know if it's this festival or all festivals, but this festival for sure, whether I'm standing on line with people for 2 hours to see Monkey Man last night, or I'm talking with the filmmakers, everybody like wants to geek out and talk about movies. And it's just like, I feel like I'm with my people.
Yeah.
Exactly. So can we geek out and talk about movies for just a
100%,
minute?
100%.
Okay. So did you see anything? What were your favorite things that you saw?
You know, I saw the Nicolas Cage Arcadian.
Oh, I heard that was cool. I was doing interviews when that premiere happened, so I was bummed.
And my wife went. She got an express pass, and she got in line really early, so she saved us seats, like on the fifth row,
like on Nicolas Cage's lap.
Yeah, and the screen was really big, and it's a very intense, like, you know, kind of sci-fi thriller, post-apocalyptic thing. So that was a really fun movie experience. I did go to Roadhouse, but I had like the nosebleed.
Yeah, yeah.
So I could watch this on my phone. It would be bigger.
Yeah. I saw Monkey Man last night in the, you know, just about the back. And it was the same thing. Like, I could watch it on my phone. But also the way the theater is made, it's an old theater, which is part of the charm.
Yeah, super cool.
But the way the theater is made, once you're in a certain point, there's like safety bars that block your view of the movie. Yeah. So I and then there's a very tall guy in front of me. So I watched that movie vertical because my head was like sideways throughout
there,
it.
There you go.
Roadhouse was a blast. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I actually can't wait to see it again where I can be really immersed in even the camera language and some of the stunts.
The stunts were wild. And we were great seats for that.
Yeah. So that's it. You probably had a totally different experience. But no, I mean, I love the energy. I mean, the headliners are always fun to get out there and see, like, the bigger movies. But, you know, I got one of the best things that I've seen is, and I met the filmmaker at the filmmaker lunch, Jeremy. It's called Secret Mall Apartment.
Oh, man. Everybody's talking about that.
So good.
I didn't get a chance to see it, but every time I was coming out of the Alamo, everybody was like chattering about that
movie. Yeah, it's really charming. And it's just, have you ever seen, I haven't talked to Jeremy since I saw it, but I'll have to mention this to him, see what he thinks about the comparison. But it was kind of like a smaller version in a way of the type of character was, at least, Man on Wire.
Oh.
Remember Man on
Wire? Yeah. French dude.
Yeah, the Philippe Petit. And he's just so passionate about living, and his life is his art. Yeah. And so it's another character kind of like that. I mean, he's not doing like death-defying stuff, but he's just like very sincere, earnest artist who just wants to live as art. And it's so the title is almost a misnomer because they do this like kind of long-term stunt in this mall, but it's really about a character study of this guy, and he's really sweet.
That's really cool. Have you the best theater experience I had this weekend? And maybe like this could be like the best theater experience I've had in a very, very long time. Like collective experience was saw the premiere of Oddity, which I can't stop talking enough about. That one, just everyone was just strapped in and we all screamed for 90 minutes.
Really? It's horror, obviously.
It's psychological horror. It's not gory. It's okay. Not. In fact, I saw a lot of other things this weekend that were gross. Like the gross out was part of the experience.
Yeah.
This was all in your head, someone lurking, jump scares, and you know that's what you've signed up for.
Yeah.
And there was like the director, Damien McCarthy, did such a good job with the terror of it all. And the audience were just such great participants that by the end, we were all screaming and then just chuckling at how much we were screaming because, like, we just, like, you knew the scares were coming and we were still like, no, help, help.
I mean, there is something just magical, even if it's like an action thing or even, you know, really anything that's when you're at a festival like this and it's a packed house. And everybody there freaking came to a festival and they love movies.
Yeah.
And they just give themselves over to it. And I mean, like when we watched Arcadian yesterday and people are like cheering when Nick Cage comes in and, you know, or when like Badass like hits the monster, like, yeah, you know, and just like you miss that because you go to the AMC multiplex in your town and there's like eight people, you know, or whatever. So I love being at a festival.
Yeah, movie theaters are just so freaking great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, at the end of every interview, we love to get just recommendations. Now, we've talked about a lot of things that you like, but like we all love movies here.
Yeah.
So it can be, you know, we don't care if it's what you watched on the plane here or what you like to watch with your kids. Okay. You know, it doesn't have to be the festival.
I've already got two for you.
Good. Just keep going. Cause people just want to hear it. And cause the audience has gotten to know you now. So now they're like, this guy made this awesome.
These films have nothing to do with like films I've made, but one of the best films I saw last year, which I wish would have had a foreign foreign language film nomination and didn't, was The Eight Mountains.
Oh, cool. What's that?
It's a friendship movie that takes place in the Italian Alps, and it's based on a book, and it's a slower movie, and but the nuance of it and how little dialogue is needed to get these deep emotional moments. And then just the landscape, it's shot 4x3 and just these mountain landscapes. And it's really these two guys reconciling their issues with their dad and then their friendship over 40 years or whatever.
Wow.
Beautiful film. I saw it in Portland in a little art house theater, but it was at Cannes. I mean, it won a big award at Cannes, so it's not like a tiny movie. And then what was the movie I was talking about? Oh, you know, Denis Villeneuve, who, you know, Dune 2 is out. Obviously, he's like one of the, you know, masters that we have in his generation right now, making great films.
My sister's favorite filmmaker, and Dune 2 was pretty rad.
I haven't seen it yet.
It was like one of those ones where I was like, oh, it's so cool to see something I feel like I've never seen.
So the first time I was acquainted with him is I was at a film festival in the early aughts in Europe. And his film Maelstrom, really early, because he's French-Canadian. And so
I grew up in Montreal, so we're hyper aware of Denis Villeneuve. He's very important to us.
Yeah. Well, I love his early film Maelstrom, which is literally has this like Shakespearean, you know, narrator that's a fish. The fish is narrating the film in some underworld thing. But above ground, it's just like the most normal film. So there's just, it's so weird and it's so awesome and so visceral. And it's like a kind of a tragic love story. But I got to go back and watch like early Villeneuve before he was making like massive movies and realize this is where this guy came from. Like the guy making Dune 2 made a weird movie in the early aughts where a fish narrates.
I love that you say that because something I've heard people talk about this weekend just is that, you know, if you make one thing, people think that's the one thing you can make.
Exactly.
And whether it's Villeneuve, whether it's Spielberg, whether it's Peter Jackson, like, these are guys, or you know, these guys made big, big movies, like huge, massive things. But when you think about all the different stuff they can do, like, no one's now being like, oh, Peter Jackson can't make a big movie because he made Bad Taste. Have you ever seen Bad Taste?
No.
I mean, that is a weird ass New Zealand horror, low budget thing, and really weird. I mean, extremely weird. But I really like when people aren't typecast.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard as a director because, I mean, there's so much money involved, so much money that it takes to get a movie made. And so you do kind of have to, you end up kind of having to make a different version of what you've already made. And so you kind of, you go down this like little rabbit hole a bit. As part of my last film was about three teenagers and the last one that I directed, I've been involved in a bunch of films since, but the one I directed that I premiered in 2018 at South By was called Social Animals, and it was about three teenagers and their Instagram accounts. And then it's a lot different than Dickweed, let's put it that way. But that was part of it is like, I want to swing because I'm very interested in crime, but I'm not only interested in crime. But I'd made this film that I, you know, put a lot of heart into and I really cared about, but I was like, I really want, range-wise, I just want to do this other thing. Because I don't want to just, I mean, I got hit up so many times, like, would you consider this social media documentary or this one? I was like, no, I don't want to make social media documentaries. Like, I thought these kids were interesting, you know, like, whatever. So I think it's like, it's kind of just the nature of the beast. But it's great to see the range, especially with big filmmakers that, to American audience, like Denis Villeneuve, you know, that they might not have known the kind of stuff they had that's much more European sensibility, which, you know, is just, there's a lot of nuance and depth there that you don't always get in American cinema.
Cool. Well, our filmmaker today, Jonathan Ignatius Green, the film is Dickweed. It is such a cool, intense ride. Thank you for getting me up early on this Tuesday morning.
No worries.
To do this interview. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Friday Night Movie, the sibling rivalry and pop culture podcast. Join the Friday Night Movie family by following @FryNightMovie on all of the socials and visiting our website, FryNightMovie.com. Our theme song is by What Does It Eat? And make sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.